Welcome to the Matthew Moran Podcast. Here you'll discover a series of in-depth conversations with some of the world's leading nature photographers, filmmakers, conservationists, editors, writers, and publishers. Gain unique insights into the lives of industry experts and the unsung heroes, their personal stories, creative processes, and how they make their passion sustainable. We also explore the role photography and filmmaking play in engaging audiences around the world about the global challenges facing wildlife. And despite the often grim statistics, we focus on solutions and discuss what each of us can do to contribute to conservation efforts. I'm incredibly grateful to all my guests who generously give up their time to share their wisdom, and I'm really excited to bring these inspiring conversations to you. Back again so soon, but it is Christmas time, and if you're here and you haven't yet listened to Aaron Joukowsky's podcast, please head back one episode and check him out. Thanks for all the kind comments that have come in so far about that. I hope you're having a lovely time, maybe allowing yourself to laze around a little bit and, you know, listen to a podcast about nature photography and filmmaking and presenting, editing, kind of a one-stop shop. People interested in conservation storytelling and how on earth you make a living doing what you love. And this week I was so thrilled to interview Jaime Rojo. It has been an unbelievable year for him with his monarch butterfly work, winning in countless competitions, also a cover story for National Geographic. But it hasn't ended there, and you will find out more when you listen to this. So a quick note again to say thanks again to all the Patreon supporters who signed up this year. It's been such a help having your support. That is enough from me. Here's Jaime. Jaime, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, taking the time. And I feel like this is a really good time at the end of the year to be able to reflect on, well, from what on the outside, it looks like a pretty incredible year for you and your work. And it's been a long time coming. You know, this sort of success that we talk about does not come overnight. And, you know, personally, we met so many times just in October at Montfoto at the beginning of October, then Wildlife Photographer of the Year, and then Bristol at Wild Photos, and then GDT. And that was just October, but you've had an incredible, busy and unbelievable year. So, like, have you had time to stop and reflect?
Thank you, Matt. I am starting to stop now. Stop is not an immediate, it's a process for me. Stopping is a process. So I am starting that process right now.
And how do you do that? Like, are you spending time with family, unwinding, you know, thinking about what this year's been and brought for you? Of course, we'll talk about all the successes in the competitions with your work with the monarch butterflies. Obviously, we're going to talk about this a lot as we go forward. But yeah, are you, you know, we've just talked about you having some insomnia, struggling to sleep. You are a 100 miles an hour person, but are you kind to yourself? Do you give yourself some time to relax and slow down? Or is it not really you?
Again, no, I am. It's difficult for me to slow down. Everybody that knows me well know that I live with a lot of intensity. Life is an intense thing for me. I do find calm in nature. That's what I'm trying to do. I haven't been able to spend as much time in nature as I wanted after this amazing year. But yes, of course, my family, some quiet time. I'm very much looking forward to the Christmas break and spending some time with the family and just chilling. But honestly, I think every creative person that I know is a bit like us, no? Like, I'm always thinking of new ideas, and that's a problem. That's a problem. It's like, I want to do so many things. And you know what? I learned something. Time is limited. And I'm learning this now. So at this moment of my life, I really need to choose. I have to choose what can I do? What can I do great? Where can I live life at the fullest possible way? And definitely spending time in nature, spending time with my family, cooking and reading, I would say, are things that give me calm.
Yeah, that sounds so great. And it's such a cliche again, because from the outside, it looks like, you know, when you see the videos and you know, people follow you on social media, oh, wow, what an incredible life. He's in the cloud forest all the time, or he's photographing monarchs, or he's in Andorra. But, you know, the reality is these days are so limited and they're so precious. And even then you're under so much pressure to get these shots that you need to tell certain stories, that actually the reality is we're all doing what we do now is sitting in front of a screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to be the Christmas photography Grinch to tell you that our job is not as shiny as it looks from. I love it. We have the best job in the world. I couldn't do any other thing right now, but it comes with trade-offs, no?
Yeah,
it comes with trade-offs, of course. Definitely.
Of course. And yeah, going back, I mean, I became aware of your work actually with the work you did with WWF back in 2016 with the River Dolphins. And, you know, so I've been following you kind of since then. But obviously this year has really culminated. And let's talk a bit about the monarchs, unless you're completely over talking about monarchs, because every time I see you, you're talking about them, you know, with the success you've had in the competition. But obviously this was not just about this year. This has been work that you've been doing for the past 20 years. And can you just tell us a brief overview about how this journey started, and also talk a bit, because what I'm personally interested in, because my journey is similar, is, you know, you've mentioned on a number of occasions, you know, moving from pure wildlife photography into becoming more of a photojournalist and telling stories about human-animal conflict and their relationships, and, you know, how that kind of transcended your work with the monarchs.
Okay. I registered like 15 possible answers from your long question. So I do have some more monarch talk under my sleeve. I'm happy to.
Some fresh talk. Great.
I don't know, fresh. Yeah. Yeah, there are some fresh things that I am going to share with you later. But basically this all started when I fell in love with the nature of Mexico, thanks to the work of a Mexican conservation photographer, Patricio Robles Gil. I ran into his books. He had an organization called Sierra Madre, had these beautiful, beautiful books about the biodiversity of Mexico. And I remember a photo of the monarchs. Obviously, it was just one more species in the myriad of beautiful things that you can see in Mexico. But of course, that concentration of butterflies is very unique in the world. So it was in my list. And fast forward a few years, I am a very passionate naturalist. I am a very serious amateur photographer because I started very young on photography, like many of us as a kid, with an old camera. That's a cliche. And I got a grant to finish my environmental science studies in Mexico.
So that's how you first went to Mexico.
Exactly.
So you were studying in Spain.
Yes, I was studying environmental sciences in Madrid, in Spain. That's where I grew up. And I wanted to go to Mexico to experience that biodiversity and that wild nature in the first hand. I got this grant, and the grant was, the idea was to spend 6 months doing the thesis, no, the final project for my college studies. And then spend some time volunteering in a conservation nonprofit. That's what I wanted to do, work in conservation, and then come back to Spain and create my own nonprofit and do conservation. That was the plan. No, when you are 20, plans are feeble. So the plan ended up being almost 20 years living a very intense and beautiful life in Mexico. But going back to those early days in Mexico, so early that on the third day, after arriving in Mexico with my grant and, you know, everything's new, I meet some friends that invite me to go to the Monarch Sanctuaries. And I say, of course, I want to go. I had my old film camera. I went there and I was captivated by the spectacle. Matt, it's just, if you have been there, I was captivated by the spectacle. It's beautiful. You see these butterflies flying. They are shiny orange against the blue sky. You can hear the sound they make because they flutter in the millions. So there's like a whisper. You can even feel the air currents that they create. So the numbers, the sheer numbers blew my mind. And it was amazing. But to be honest, it was never my first choice to develop a professional body of work. Fast forward a few more years, and I was working in a conservation nonprofit in Mexico City, and I had a 9-to-5 job. I had an apartment there. I had to go to an office. But on the weekends, I would explore the mountains surrounding Mexico, these amazing volcanoes with names that are very difficult to pronounce, no? Like Iztaccíhuatl, Popocatépetl. And the forests around these volcanoes are a biodiversity hotspot. And I started to document those mountains and those forests. And my first obsession in those forests was the volcano rabbit, actually, a very endangered and endemic rabbit that only lives in the foothills of these volcanoes. But wow. It was also there where I had the first encounters with the monarchs.
And okay, but this was like a side project to your day job.
Bueno, just briefly, it was my passion.
What was
passion
your day
project.
Job? What was your day job at that time?
I was working in conservation in a non-profit. So that's what I studied for. And I was doing half of the time was pure conservation work. The other half was conservation communications. So I was already applying my passion for photography. I was learning a lot. I was working with Patricio Robles Gil, this photographer. And it was a great experience to start a career as a conservation photographer. But I knew I needed a passion project, a professional body of work that I had developed of my own, no? And I started with these mountains, but soon enough, I realized that monarchs was eye candy. People seem to love monarchs, and I have confirmed that in 2024. There's this, they go nuts with monarchs. They are very beautiful
species.
Yeah, it's
funny, isn't it, how we just decide on one species?
It's not just any species. There are many migrating insects. There are many beautiful butterflies. But the combination of the monarchs being so beautiful, the migration being so epic, and the story having these elements of narrative that we all like. We all like these good stories.
Of course, it's just innate, isn't it? Within humans, it's the story. And that's absolutely what captivates us.
So we are drawn to those kind of stories. And I decided to focus a little bit more because it was close to Mexico City. That's the pragmatic approach that I took. It took me less than 2 hours to be there. And I was very constant documenting, as you said earlier, the beauty. I started doing beautiful photos of the winter hibernation of the monarchs in central Mexico. That's how I started.
I mean, it sounds really similar. When you're concentrating on the beauty, you're mostly focusing on honing your technical skills and looking at your mentors. And I guess in those times as well, you know, pre-digital, not everybody's a wildlife photographer like they are today. It's also very tough. You're not seeing what you're getting. You're going through rolls and rolls of film, spending crazy money on processing. And then that's even before you've scanned anything. And so, you know, I often refer to photographers of our generation of kind of learning the hard way, but then there are also benefits of the way, you know, that we learned like that. And we're going to talk about Missouri Photo Workshop later, mm-hmm. but that was one of the great things that I didn't really struggle with was with this limit that we have, you know, during that workshop of 400 frames, because I think growing up on film kind of makes you resourceful when you are taking those pictures. And so this passion project that you were doing, you're working for a conservation organization, were you then using those images as, you know, like you were saying, you were learning about communication and that was also part of your job. Were you then using your own photographs to build campaigns and tell stories and you know, do the job of the conservationist, but as a visual storyteller?
My own photographs, not so much, because I was working with this photographer that had amazing work, but I was given some opportunities to experience the real life of a conservation photographer. And that is, I think it's a better experience than just publishing. For me, being able to hang out like I did in the cloud forest of El Triunfo with some of the international stars of our youth, no? Or to work closely with someone and to understand the challenges of completing a long-term project. So all of that, and also, Matt, I think something that was very valuable for me at the beginning was that I was learning how to apply the power of storytelling into different products. We were doing books, we were doing brochures. We started very early with film and video. No, before anyone was doing, before cameras were able to do video, we were using video cameras and I was editing and learning the craft. So that was very helpful as a... I had a very early start as a photographer. And then my development was very long. I took a long time because I was working on conservation full time and I wasn't sure I wanted to be a full-time photographer. I knew I wanted, deep in my heart, I wanted, but I wasn't brave enough. I needed the leap of faith that I often refer to. No, you at some point you need to face the void and say, okay, am I going to do this or am I going to stay on the safe side? And I decided to jump.
And when did you take that jump? Because I think it's such a great story to tell. Like there, I was having a conversation with someone about this yesterday who's transitioning. It's a different field from us. And they were saying that, you know, they don't feel quite ready yet. They know it's going to happen. And actually, it's a much more slow burn. And that was also what happened with me. I did, you know, I suppose in a way there is some leap at some point because you have to say no to the other work. But there's this phrase that I love, you know, if you leap, the net will appear. So there is, you know, like you talked about not feeling brave enough, but at some point you have to be brave enough to take that decision. So can you tell us about that experience, like emotionally as well, what it was like and, you know, oh my God, how am I going to pay my rent? How am I going to fly home to see my family?
Yeah.
You know, you come from this, you know, there's not lots of money in conservation, but at least you have a regular salary, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You are describing my life. I had a very meager salary. And I completely disagree with that sentence that you jump and then the net is magically there. No, you jump and while you are falling, you are weaving or netting. No, you are
knitting the
net. You are creating the net for yourself and you are clinging yourself to anything that prevents from that fall. For me, the leap of faith came after a conservation congress that I organized with two of my mentors in Mexico. It was the 9th World Wilderness Congress. And I had been invited to be the executive director for Mexico. And it was a big opportunity with a significant increase in my paycheck. And I saw it. So it was, I was at a crossroads because this offer came when I was almost ready. The offer came when I was almost ready to become a professional photographer. I had just done a very nice expedition in El Triunfo Cloud Forest with these professional photographers and the first rave of the ILCP. I was super pumped up with the experience. But then this came along and I said, okay, maybe a couple more years to expand my network, to learn more, and I did that. And I will never know if it was a mistake because it was a brutal experience that I didn't enjoy that much. Organizing events is not my thing, but I met wonderful people. I learned so much and I know so much more about conservation now thanks to doing that work than what I did before, no? So after the event, I decided that was enough. I took 6 months of sabbatical time, and probably the best time of my life, drinking coffee, reading books, you know, doing sports and reading architectural books. I don't know why I got like fixated on architectural books. And I started pitching ideas to potential clients. I already think of it like I already knew how to do the job. It's just that I wasn't doing it full time or getting paid professionally for that. But I knew how to do it. And I got my first project with WWF Mexico to do a campaign to protect the last free flowing river of the Western Sierra Madre. It's called the San Pedro Mezquital River. And it was a big project to start with. And it was a big success too. So it was a great start as a freelancer.
That's such a great story. And I love that you talk about these crossroads and actually not going for the thing that you really wanted to do in your heart. So having this kind of, you know, sensible route that you took, the security, but also understanding that there was a value in that in terms of networking, in terms of like learning and understanding how conservation works. Because actually that's one of the really difficult things. And, you know, I was going to may as well talk to you about this now in terms of, you know, being a conservation photographer. You are, yes, spending a lot of time on your own. Yeah, I know on occasions you're working with assistants, but essentially, if you want to, or if we want to get our images out there, we have to work with magazines, we have to work with NGOs, we have to work with organizations. And so having that experience that you did as a conservationist and then applying that as a photographer, you also probably understand all the kind of politics around NGOs and the infighting and how to avoid all of this and, you know, work with the right ones. I mean, I know that WWF, I hear good things about them in terms of, you know, where they pay and the way they, you know, organize these campaigns. You know, there are a few that we all know about that are good to work with. Just unfortunately, there are too many photographers for not enough jobs. But anyway, I'm kind of going off on a bit of a tangent. It sounds like this was a really great start. And so this, I like your metaphor of kind of weaving the net. It's almost like this was the first knot for you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And let me say something. It's very different to work with some of the big nonprofits as a conservationist than as a photographer, no?
Okay.
So that's a very clear distinction that I had to learn the hard way. There's often some of the conservation projects have great budgets because there is budget for big impact in conservation. And often you are surprised by the fact that some of these organizations don't have the communication budget they should. But I have been blessed of working with some of the best, I think, and having great experiences. Like, I consider myself very lucky. Like, or how a good friend always quotes someone, because I don't know whose sentence is this or whose quote is this. No, the harder I try, the luckier I get. Because I have tried very hard, Matt. Very hard, very hard, very hard. And I have gotten lucky. I consider myself a privilege. A privilege because I have a job that is amazing, that I get these experiences that are unique. And I feel that I'm doing something useful. Or I try to feel that because that's the dark side of our job. And we can talk about that later, no? We all fall in despair from time to time. But bueno, let's not get into that too early.
No, but it's good. I think I love your optimistic approach and, you know, spending time with you at the GDT Festival and in Bristol. That's, I think it's important because, yeah, we talk about this a lot on the podcast. Like, how do you have hope with, you know, the political situation globally, with the biodiversity crisis globally? You know, you feel like what you're doing is so tiny in comparison. But yeah, I like hearing you say that. And I hope it emboldens the listeners as well, because I think it is important what we do. And I'm always one also because I'm British, you know, you never want to like, oh, I'm the hero with the camera. But actually, yeah, if you are touching people globally, whether that's through your social media or talking with National Geographic or being on the stage at European Wildlife Photographer of the Year, you are reaching people and that is important. And also, I also think it's important that you're inspiring like people like me and our peers. We're all kind of inspirational for each other to continue to do, you know, important work. And it gets, you know, it gets harder and harder. I mean, in fact, you know, I was, you know, when I was interviewing Aaron Jacoski last, you know, we were talking about just the limited ways of getting our work out there now, you know, compared to, you know, relatively recently Instagram. He was complaining, you know, that Instagram used to actually be a really good platform where you could reach, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. And, you know, I go on it now and it's like every other post is just junk or advertising. Of course, it still has its place. But aside from that, we all know about National Geographic and the subscription numbers going way down. You know, what are your thoughts around this, especially someone who's had, particularly this year with your Monarch story, you know, such great exposure and success through that magazine, but knowing that those outlets are diminishing year by year, how do you feel that you're going to get your work out to, you know, a wide audience?
I mean, in population ecology, there is a concept called the shifting baselines. And that concept, I love it because it applies to many things in life. Shifting baselines is, oh, no. Fish used to be like this when I, but that memory is forgotten because fish for a century have always been like this. And you keep forgetting that the baseline is constantly changing. So you can live a very happy life in the modern times if you don't hear about the past.
Yeah. I should just say for the listeners that Jaime was holding his hands like wide. Fish used to be like this, really big, and now they're really small.
Thank you. Oh, yeah, thank you.
No,
apologize,
that's fine.
Listeners. I should know this already at this point. But yes. So I was doing this exaggeration of how when you only look at the narrow scope of the present, and the very grim scope of the future. Well, sometimes the present can't feel enough. When you compare it to the past, obviously there is this contrast and this shock. And many of the discomforts of professional photographers know by realizing that today it's very difficult to achieve the kind of work that we do compared to what it was in the past. But it's true that for many of the photographers of our generation, this is a struggle. It's not, I don't live the great life. Like, I have to work very hard to make the meet the numbers and to make the ends meet. No, I have to work very hard. But I also consider myself lucky. The problem always comes when you compare things to the past. And it's the same in conservation. You think, oh, look at this. I look in this beautiful place because I do look in a beautiful place. You compare how much of my place was built in the 50s, no, or the wilderness that we had only a few years ago. And it's depressing. But the shifting baselines continue to fool us as a species. And it's something that I am very interested in as a philosophical concept, no? So in photography, in our business, is the same. None of the platforms that we used to work with are as healthy and as reliable as they were before. But I cannot complain because I have been able to live a full life and to sustain myself and to work with my partner to sustain our family doing nature and conservation photography. Come on, that has to be, that has to be like I cannot complain. I am.
No, it's true. It's good. It's really good. And actually, you're reminding me of, you know, this Dutch photographer, David Hoop. Mm-hmm. He did these lovely stories of the bears, and he was at Montfoto. And he, when I first saw him, and there were a group of us, he laughed because we were all talking, and he said, "It's like boom. It's like within seconds, everybody is moaning. Everyone's moaning about the state of the industry. Everybody's moaning about not getting enough money. Everybody's moaning about not getting the breaks." But then you're right. If you turn it, flip it and say, hold on a second, look at us all. We're all here. You know, some of us being paid to be here. You're here because you're a winning photographer or because you're presenting work. Like this is an incredible privilege. There would be so many younger photographers wanting to be in our shoes right now. And you're right. It's a human nature thing. The grass is always greener. Things were always, especially as you get older, things are always better in the past, you know?
Yes, absolutely. and Matt, nobody, forced us to choose this job.
Yeah.
No, there are great corporate jobs out there. If you want to try them, there are great jobs. Nobody forced us. So I guess it's not my role to complain, but it is my role to defend our industry. And for that, we need to work together. And it's very important. These kind of conversations, and we do it a lot. We talk among our peers. And we try to keep a common position and keep our ground because otherwise we will be swept away by this wave of cheap content, artificial intelligence, and we can open that Pandora box and it will be another conversation.
Yeah, it's another podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's great, Jaime. It's inspiration, certainly for me as well. And because I'm guilty of it too. We all are, you know, it's just, mm-hmm. Oh my God, there's not a week that goes by still where, you know, I don't get requests for work and, you know, the organization or the NGO like has no budget or, oh, could you come and speak in our university? There's no mention of money. And it's just, you know, there is this like, you know, expectation. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's the same, I think, for everybody. You know, when I interviewed Charlie, he talked about Charlie Hamilton James, you know, mm-hmm. success doesn't necessarily make you happy. It just makes you very busy. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's something you could attest to as well this mm-hmm. year. Underneath all of that success. I wanted to talk about you moving back to Spain after living in Mexico for 20 mm-hmm. years. And one thing you said to me on the train in Germany, which made me smile, was that you said you'd become like more North American. You'd lost all your Spanishness, you know, been going to bed at 9:30 at night and you've got a bit of a twang to your accent. So, you know, is that, you know, you've been back in Madrid now, what, for how long? Is all of that, are you kind of like re-nationalized? Have they accepted you back?
Yeah. Like full-time in Spain, completely full-time. Like I declared myself full-time in Spain when I transfer my tax-paying duties from Mexico to Spain. And that was in January 2020. Okay. I was living in Seville with my partner and our daughters. And yes, I mean, I am a strange Spaniard if you compare to the average. Like the things I do, the things I eat, how early I go to bed, I rarely drink. I like that kind of things are not the common. But I am trying and I appreciate many of the wonderful things of this country. It's just that all my professional career has been developed in the Americas. I grew professionally there. I got used to the way things are done in the Americas. And therefore I find myself a little bit lost with the photographic culture here in Spain. And I have great friends from Spain, but most of the people I know, professional nature photographers, make a living in a very different way than I do. Most of the people do photo tours or workshops or things that I don't normally do.
Yeah. And how are you managing it? You know, I'm always interested in other photographers and, you know, like you are as well, you know, other photographers, how do you make it pay? And also how you juggle this work life balance, you know, like you say, you have a partner and two daughters and traveling mm-hmm. a lot. And yeah, how do you kind of maximize your efficacy as a photographer and a father and a partner? I'm lucky because almost mm-hmm. all of my work is like 10 or 20 minutes from my house. So I don't have that issue. But for photographers that are traveling a lot, I can imagine it's a tough one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It is probably the hardest part of our job these days. How do you manage it? With lots of love, with lots of speaking and talking and sharing. And I have a wonderful partner that has supported my career when I was starting, and then I was able to support her when she was transitioning to a different kind of job, and then we support each other. But it's challenging. Even ourselves, we have been together forever, and it's difficult because with the family and the girls and the daily chores of life, it's very complicated because I sometimes have to leave for a long time. So I try to restrict my travel to a limit that it's unbearable, no? And then you keep it there and it becomes more complicated. I wish I could do more work locally, but as I said, many of the stories that I engaged a decade ago continue to be part of what I do today.
And yeah, you put down enough roots in 20 years that's mm-hmm. your contact base is there. Mm-hmm. It's where you know si. The work and yeah. Si. And is that something that you're perhaps thinking about doing, is focusing more on European projects? I know the transition would be slow in doing that, and it's not so easy just to kind of find a project and start doing it. But like if you think about the next 20 years.
I have thought about that, especially back when I was living in Mexico. I always wanted a project that would allow me to root here. But the truth, Matt, is as I started saying earlier, like I have come to realize the finitude of life, of our life. And it's terrible when you actually do it and you realize that I am no longer young. I am no longer the young kid in the room. Not anymore. I was for many years. I was the youngest in the room. Now I am not. And the time is limited. The ideas are limited. And I have a few projects in the pipeline that will keep me busy for the next few years. So if I see the opportunity, the way I work is if there is a great idea, I need to be sure I'm going to be able to make a living out of that idea. Yeah. I have become more conservative now. So I want to make sure that if I choose an idea, it's an idea that I'm going to be able to sell later. And something that happens here in Europe is that the spaces are more limited. And therefore, in a more crowded physical space, there is a more density of talent that I have to compete against. And there are great things to do here. And I would love to do some work here. But I am not obsessing. I am not actively transitioning to that. I have come to realize that if my place is in the Americas and if these stories are what I'm working on, there is a little bit of contradiction with my environmental attitude and messaging, the fact that I have to travel. I have considered moving back to the Americas, but right now we'll see. I am keeping myself, I'm surviving, I'm keeping myself afloat and making a living out of this. I wish I had more control over this spaceship, but I don't.
So that's a good thing. But what I do like hearing you talk about, and I think this is an advantage of getting older, is being able to say no, and also really having, in a way, respect for yourself and also respect for the people that you're working with when you know you can see how it's going to work. And like, you can see the road that you're going to take. Is this going to give me enough a finance to support mm-hmm. my family? Am I going to be able to, you know, mm-hmm. have certain periods where I don't have to work? All of these decisions, you just get better at doing that as you get older. When you're younger, you're like, yes, any opportunity, you know, you will take. Mm-hmm. And, but yeah, that, of course, that doesn't make it, it doesn't make it any easier. And, you know, we've talked about this as well on the podcast. I talked about it with Marcus Westberg, you know, about traveling. And of course, it's something that we have to do. But, you know, being mindful of the consequences of that and the irony of it. We're talking about the environment, but we're flying everywhere. But, you know, perfection just doesn't exist. And, you know, they're obviously all of us in an ideal world. And, you know, things are changing, I think, you know, with the way the World Press Photo Awards is, you know, operating now, and also post-COVID, you know, people... That's the funny thing. This used to be my special niche. Oh yeah, I do like stuff close to home. And now everybody's doing stuff close to home. Yeah, but that's great. It is good.
At this moment, I want to take an advantage because you, the audience is not, but do you see where I live? Do you see those
incredible
mountains?
Foothills of some beautiful
mountains. I live in the
mountains.
Foothills of a national park. So obviously I would like to work here, but it you said very clearly, it depends if you are able to find an economically sustainable project in this region. And unfortunately, when you grow up doing things the American way, it is very difficult to do things the Spanish way. Those are two worlds and don't mix very well together. Yeah. And that's
so. Look, if the boss of that national park just around the corner from your house is listening, can you please like give Jaime a job? It would be perfect. You could walk there almost.
Yeah, you should see the density of amazing photographers that we have in town, of just landscape and mountaineers and better mountaineers, better climbers, and many of them better landscape photographers than I am. So, but anyway.
You did do a project close to home, which actually I first learned about when we spent some time at the GDT and you showed me this beautiful book about Andorra. So yeah, tell us a bit about that project, and because it sounded amazing in terms
that,
of-
That was
like,
amazing.
You know, having a task, like producing a book, like it's, I mean, mm-hmm. I know these things are not simple, but being commissioned to make a book, you know, between the government, between National Geographic, this seemed like a really nice job to work on. And I know that you said as much yourself that this was a really lovely project. So yeah, tell us a bit about that because this was something close to home.
It was close to home and it came just in the right time. So picture this. I had moved back to Spain in 2020, no? I was full-time living in Spain, and I got this opportunity by National Geographic Spain to do something in Andorra. It was not just a book. I started as a digital campaign, but then they liked it and it grew into a book and a film for National Geographic Channel, and we ended the project with an amazing immersive experience. So Andorra gave me the opportunity to work closer to home in a time that I needed it most because I didn't have any projects in Mexico off the ground and I didn't have anything in my home country. So I needed, and it was a great project. Then the pandemic came and both Andorra and National Geographic were super flexible and allowed me to reframe the project a little bit. And overall, I worked for 3 years, almost full time in Andorra. It had an amazing impact. It started more of a commercial or a branded content project, something that I was a bit uncomfortable at the beginning. But in the end, I managed to turn a little bit towards conservation. And I was very happy with it because it came out to be a project of discovery for the people of Andorra. They were
That's amazing.
Amazed. Yeah, it was amazing. The result was
so
amazing.
So originally it was more set out in a way of promoting the land or as a tourism mm-hmm. kind of
exactly,
piece.
Exactly. Yeah. But it was a great project to consolidate the 30-30 vision in Andorra for conservation. And it created this sense of national pride beyond our mountains. Our mountains also have amazing wildlife, and this wildlife is trapped here and climate change. So we were able to speak about very complicated concepts, and it came out nicely and beautiful, and they were very generous, and I was given creative freedom. At the beginning, it's always difficult with this project, with a new client, and they were not used to my way of doing things. But soon, as we started rolling, It was a privilege, and I have enjoyed that experience a lot. And it gave me the stability, both the local project and the the economics, the finance stability that I needed when I had moved back to Spain.
Yeah, that sounds great. And also sounds kind of deserved. I think every now and again you get these projects that the timing is just right. You know, the logistics are good. And
a little bit.
We will put links up to all of this work. Obviously, your website's great. I've been diving in there a lot over the last few days with lots of videos and lots of content. And yeah, can people still buy the book, for example?
Unfortunately, the book was never available for sale. Vale? It was a book for promotion. It was only for promotion. That was something that I found very difficult to swallow, to accept that we will never be able to sell this book. But at the same time, they were able to do a larger edition, and I had some of those books, and I have used it actively. They have used it actively to promote the country and their nature. So, but you can watch the Andorra Al Natural film on YouTube, on the National Geographic channel of Spain. So if you type in Andorra Al Natural National Geographic, that's the first result you get in YouTube. And it's a film that I did that was also quite funny because I'm the host. And it's, you follow the steps of this photographer trying to document the wild nature of Andorra.
Brilliant. We will, we'll definitely point people in that direction. Okay, look, I'm conscious this is a short, sharp hour and there's a few more things I want to get through. But, you know, we talked again a bit. I think when we were at the Wildlife Photographer of the Year, this discovery, I hadn't known that you did the Missouri Photo Workshop back in, where were you, 2014? Did you
2014, yes.
2014, yeah. So 10 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And I mean, everybody has a tough time there. It's a pretty brutal experience, but it sounded like you had a really brutal, tough time.
I did, man. It was brutal.
But we talked a lot about the Missouri Photo Workshop with Sarah Lean, who's obviously a legend of National Geographic, and she's taught now there as a tutor for many, many years. And if people can find out more about that from her, but like, tell us a bit about your experience. First of all, how you found out about it and why you wanted to do it at that stage in your career.
I think they should give Sarah and Kathy Moran a badge, because Kathy Moran has been exporting photographers, referring photographers to the Missouri Photo Workshop forever. So for me, it was Kathy, and it was with Monarchs, and it was the classical conversation. These photos are beautiful. I love this. What is the story? And I say, what? What are you talking about? What is the story of what? And then, what's the story? And she says, you should check out this workshop. And then I got interested in this concept of story. For me, as for many other nature photographers that started as biologists, and we all focus on species and beauty, and you don't want to see a human element in your pictures. You start like, if there's a power line, you frame carefully to avoid showing that power line, and you show this distorted beauty of our planet, no, by selectively editing out, no, when you frame the things you don't want. And for me, that was people. People was a nuisance in my pictures. And if I included people, they were devoid of any presence or character. They were maybe a reference for scale, and then some things changed. Some books changed me. I read about Magnum and started to see this beautiful, I think I have it somewhere over here, but this Magnum stories is a collection of some of the best Magnum stories in history. And Henri Cartier-Bresson. And I read some biography of some of these street photographers. And I got very inspired. But definitely, when I signed up for the Missouri Photo Workshop, I didn't know exactly what I was signing up for. And it was really, really difficult for me. I had a hard time pitching. I had a hard time meeting the people in the small town. I don't know if the audience is familiar, but it's, you have to be in a small town in Missouri, less than 5,000 inhabitants. And then in a week, you have to be able to identify a story. You have to pitch the story to your team of editors. You have to get it green-lighted. And then you have to cover and to photograph that story all in 1 week, and with a limited number of shots, in the same way that it used to be with the roll of films. You have 36.
Yeah, that came because they used to hand people 10 rolls of film when it was the film day. So you'd have 360 shots.
Okay, 360.
So they gave us 40 extra. So it's 400, 400 frame limit in 1 week. So yeah, it's they don't want you to try and create a story from 3,000 images. They want you to build from the bottom up.
And I,
how were you with that?
No, I was terrible. I think I did a terrible job. I did a terrible job, both in identifying the story. I did a terrible job with the pitching. I think they greenlighted by compassion, and then I had to shoot the whole story in 2 days. I make a great connection with this guy, the water foreman of Platte City, Missouri, Kenny Loy, very nice guy, and I met his family, but I was so uncomfortable, Matt. Like, you have to be there in their living room, they're having dinner, and he kisses her goodbye, and she picks the kids from soccer, and that kind of thing. I was not used. I didn't sleep any night at all. Like, I didn't sleep that week. And poor Randy Olson, I keep quoting him lately, no, because he was part of my faculty. It was Randy Olson, the legendary National Geographic photographer, and Erica Larsen, another legend of the photography of National Geographic. And they were like the bad cop, good cop. Like, Randy was the bad guy, and Erica was the great gal. And I remember a quote from Randy, like, yeah, you are technically okay, but you have zero empathy with your subjects. That was the summary of my... And that quote, that sentence, that I was like a bit like, oh, what the fuck, this guy, what is he saying? No, and that was the gentle push that I think I needed to try to get better. And that started the process of forcing myself to document humans and to do it better. And it's an ongoing process that I have tried to do to the best I can. But when you haven't spent that much time doing it, no, it's tricky. And you learn on the fly. So for monarchs, as you see, monarchs, many conservation stories are human stories. So I had to develop that side of my career in a very express way, if you want.
Yeah, and it's, you know, you could be talking about so many, well, almost everybody that goes on that workshop. You know, I remember there were some, you know, people in our group, you know, just with this look of like shell shocked on their face. It was so stressful. Everybody wants to tell their story. Everybody wants to do it in the best way. Of course, that's human nature. But one of the great things, or one of the many great things that, you know, came out of some of the lectures was Brian Crancy was the course leader at that time a year ago when I did it, was said, look, it's not just about this week. It's what you take on into your career. You will refer to this week in years to come. I mean, you know, you did it 10 years ago, I only did it last year, but I think about that workshop all the time. I think about the process and exactly that capturing of emotion is, in many ways, I've kind of looked back and thought, well, actually it's really similar to wildlife photography in terms of you're trying to capture a moment, you know, some incredible moment of behavior, which is very rare to capture. Mm-hmm. And I almost feel like that's the same with emotion. You can't just walk up to someone and capture an emotional moment between two people. It takes time, it takes effort, it takes a different skill set. And so, yeah, it's, of course, if it was easy, we'd all be doing it. And then, you know, applying that empathy side to the human characters in your conservation stories is as important as any beautiful, pure nature photography shot.
Yeah, many conservation photographer careers are based on stories in which the human empathy is the central element that threads everything together and connects everything together. So you see all these stories of wildlife rescue centers and reintroduced animals, and you have like the easy, accessible, charming wildlife species that you can control because they are being rescued, and then all these human elements. I think it is way more difficult to work in wilderness and in conservation of wild places and wild species, and to still find that connection beyond the classic scientific people, like scientists at work, no, doing. So it's very, it's all about a connection. I think it's about connecting, and empathy is what connects us all together. And photography can freeze that moment in time. And that's the beautiful thing of still photography for me. It's magic. That precise moment in which the person is doing something that you can say, okay, that could be me. And that's the key.
Beautifully put. Let's talk a bit about this initiative that you're taking part in. You had a delivery few minutes ago of some prints.
Yeah, sorry.
It would be good to let people know about this, you know, to get it out to as far and as wide an audience as possible. But this is Vital Impact, which some of the audience are probably familiar with, but not everybody. So can you talk a bit about this and your involvement with it?
See, many people, after the year I have had with all the visibility for the Monarch's work, and that they ask me, and what is next? No, so next.
That's a funny thing. Sorry to interrupt, but this is something that I talk to Aaron about. It happens to me all the time. You do this epic project and then people go, what's next? Like, oh my God, I've spent 20 years doing this. Give me a break.
No, but there's always a next. And that's the key thing about conservation photography. So this was a big year for the Monarchs, and next year is going to be a big year too, because it will be the 50th anniversary of the discovery of the sanctuaries by Western science, no? So I want to keep doing some things with the images I created, and one of the most immediate actions that I wanted was to fundraise money for habitat conservation and restoration. And for that, the obvious thing to do was to sell my prints. Most of my work has never been available for purchase, and I thought I could do a very time-limited fine art print sale. And I partnered with Vital Impact, the organization that Amy Vitale founded, and they are amazing because they have the know-how. They can funnel the resources to the right way. And I chose the two organizations that I have worked closely over the years, which are Monarch Watch in the US and FOSEN in Mexico. They were very helpful on my story with National Geographic and advising me over the years. So I'm offering a few of my prints, most of them from the National Geographic story. And through January 2025, you are able to purchase these prints, and the benefits, 60% of the benefits of this sale will be donated to these two organizations that are doing very good work. They are small grassroots organizations, and I thought that was a great starting point. Obviously, there is more. I am trying to pull together and to get off the ground a book about Monarchs.
Ah. Amazing. No,
something that I think is really needed, because there is not a great book about the Monarch migration photography book. There are great books of the science. I am also going to be a speaker for the National Geographic Live series next year, and I will premiere a show on Monarch butterflies probably in November 2025, and I'm starting to work on that. So there will be more Monarchs to come throughout the years.
That's great. It's good to know that you're not tired of Monarchs. I've joked, you know, that I'm trying to move away from foxes and I keep getting arse packed, but you're like, you know, this is 20 years of work. You have to make this last a long, long, long time. And
absolutely.
That's so great to hear. What about film? What about a film about the Monarchs? Is this something?
I pitched a film, but unfortunately at the same time that I was pitching the film, I think the latest Disney National Geographic production that is called Incredible Animal Journeys was under production, so there was going to be like too much overlapping of the subject, and I think. But I wanted to do a film in the same way I did the Andorra film. I wanted to do something similar, like the journey following the migration, meeting all these interesting people. It's a different film that I want to do, and I haven't abandoned that idea. All my development documents are there. It's just that time is limited. I haven't said it enough in this interview, but time is limited, and I need to organize all the pieces of this jigsaw to make it work. But definitely, I think we need another film of Monarch. It's funny because with Monarchs, people say, oh, but everything has been done with Monarchs. And I completely disagree. Like, there was a lot of Monarchs in the past, and many of the big names of our industry have worked with the Monarchs. But I had always wanted to see a comprehensive story of everything that is going on with Monarchs, and that's what I set up to achieve in the last I think 4 years. I focused very intensively on that.
Yeah, and I think that's brilliant, and it ties in nicely, you know, the kind of education from the Missouri Photo Workshop and the story element of the Monarchs. And actually, you know, that's, I think it's a really good point in terms of this is a popular species, and you're asking yourself, oh, why would I do this? Everybody's been shooting monarchs for years, and you know, they've been popping up in Wildlife Photographer of the Year for the last 20 years. And I asked the same question with when I interviewed Jasper Dust, you know, about photographing the macaques in Japan. Mm-hmm. You know, why would you go and shoot this subject? But of course, you know, it's so much more than just these animals sitting in, you know, hot bathing pools.
No.
It's
absolutely
about the connection with the people, and you know, you're spending your time to do this. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to see you speak, you know, quite a lot in the last couple of months, and I knew nothing about this migration. Mm-hmm. And that's what it takes, is, you know, even people who are in the world and in the know, thought, wow, this is an extraordinary story of this species that travels back to the same forest, and its great grandchildren are arriving there. They've never been there before. How do they know? How do they do this? Well, we don't know. So there's always more to learn. And so, yeah, I mean, it was a question of mine, which you've clearly already answered, which is you're far from finished with monarchs.
Bueno, because I think the story of the monarchs, it's bigger than itself, no? It's a story about how we produce our food. It's a story about how we tender our gardens. It's a story of, in like as a summary, it's a story about the very conflicted relationship that we have with the natural world. And that's the kind of story that I wanted to tell. So the monarchs are just an excuse to talk about bigger things. The monarchs are a great environmental indicators, and if the monarch population have been dwindling, no, have been on decline for the last 40 years, there's clearly something wrong in the ecosystems of North America. And I'm taking advantage of the love of the people of North America for the monarchs and how catchy, eye-popping they are, to tell a story about much larger issues that are at the core of actually protecting wild nature, no? We can protect one species, but what we need to do is to protect the ecosystem and to do things in a way that the ecological processes of this planet, the ecological processes that have shaped the evolutionary history of this planet for millennia, they have to remain in place. So the story of the monarchs is perfect because it touches so many different things.
Jaime, that's really beautifully put. And listen, I know you've got to go, and I would love to ask you like a million more questions, and we could turn this into a 2-hour podcast. The data says an hour is a good time, so this is probably a good time to end. But I did want to ask you about, you know, I ask all my guests this about, you know, their hopes, wishes and dreams for the future. And I think back to that moment, you know, this crossroad moment you had when you had this decision of, you know, do you stay and take this opportunity in conservation? Do you dive into photography? And it seemed like that decision was good at the time. You know, are you, you know, this is obviously a big decision to come back to Spain. You know, you've talked about possibly going back to the Americas. You know, how do you see the next? Well, first of all, tell us a little bit about what you're going to be doing before this speaker series starts in November. It's nearly a year away. You still have the beginning of 2025. I'm sure you've got some great plans. But then also, you know, what do you think about, if you do at all, think about 5-10 years in the future and what you'd like to be doing?
I do think a lot about my future, and I try to plan with time ahead. So right now I'm working on a new project also with National Geographic, which is about the impact of the border wall between Mexico and the US. How is it affecting the animal movements, particularly the great carnivores? But I'm, as I did with the monarchs, I'm trying to give a positive spin on the story, because there's a beautiful, beautiful group of people trying to change the narrative of the borderlands. All you hear about the Mexico-US borderlands is terrible, but there is people that are protecting lands. There is a group of people that are trying to create corridors for the animals through the wall. There is indigenous people doing conservation work. It's like everything everywhere else in the world. If you look closer, the closer you get to the ground is where you find more hope and more inspiration. When you talk about global stories, it's normally very depressing, because there are not great global significant environmental movements that are working. But at the ground, on the ground level, like individuals, communities, that is where I found the inspiration and hope. So that project, I have 2025 to complete it, and it's very exciting already. I got some images that I'm very happy with. It is very, very challenging, as you can imagine.
Yeah, that's great. In fact, I've just remembered some images you showed me. This is lots. So you've been doing lots of camera trap stuff. I'm not going to talk about this, but it sounds very exciting.
Very exciting. Oh, that's all I can say. That's all I will. The teaser, like, I have a few very exciting images already. And the year is looking great because I will be covering outreach and education and conservation on the ground, like the people work. I'm going to be covering it. And now there will be this speaker series with National Geographic that I am very thrilled about. It is something that, as you have seen, I enjoy talking about monarchs. I enjoy the stage. I love that energy. And I am writing a big, big project right now. I'm developing it, and I don't want to spoil anything yet, because it's like I want to make sure that everything is in place before I start announcing. But it's a project that I hope will keep me busy for the next 5 years. It's something that combines all my passions together: conservation and photography and a global view, and I really like it. But you asked me to end with a note like, how do I see myself? Like, I want to see myself, and I do see myself busy. I would like to be stable. No, I want to have maybe less stress, less stressful life. Like you quoted Charlie, like, yes, success makes you busy. I completely agree with that statement. So I am busy. I want to be busy because it's good to be busy, but I don't want to ruin my personal life just for chasing this dream. So finding the balance, try to have a nice, beautiful life, because it's short. This thing is very short, and we really need to enjoy it and to spend time outside. So for our audience this Christmas, please turn off your cell phone, go outside, spend time in wild nature. Don't buy too many things, because we don't need too many things. We need to spend time in nature and enjoy the beautiful planet that we live in.
Jaime, there's nothing else to say. This is a perfect end. And thank you so, so much. So great talking to you. I knew this would be great. Thank you for doing it at the end of such a busy year. It's such a privilege. And yeah, we're going to get this out to as many people as possible. And I defy anyone who is not a butterfly fan to just go on, you know, YouTube, go on Jaime's website, see just even one of his short talks. See, like you said, he's just exudes this amazing passion, and it's infectious. And I'm so happy to hear you're going to continue to do this, and we'll keep up with all your other projects. And yeah, it's nonstop and giving such great energy. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. And one day, no, all of us that you have interviewed, we are going to interview you, because you keep poking at us and asking all our little intimacies and secrets. And we all have to tell you our lives, and we want to know about your life, about your wonderful work close to home, and how you do you deal with your new status as a family and all of that, no?
Yeah. You're like Marcus Westberg's been trying to do that as well. He's like, yeah, I'm going to interview you. But yeah, maybe they'll come a time soon. You can fight over him who wants to interview me. Or maybe we'd have a three-way conversation.
Fantastic.
Jaime, thank you. And yeah, have a great Christmas. And yeah, we'll catch up again soon.
Same. I have really enjoyed. Thank you very much for this opportunity. You too, eh?
That was so much fun. And I just love Jaime's energy. It is infectious and also inspiring, and great to hear how grateful he is to be making a living as a conservation photographer, author, and speaker, among many other things that he does. So many of you will know Jaime from his Monarch Butterfly work, and of course, you know, it's dominated this year. But please head over to Rojo Visuals, rojovisuals.com, to see more rich content, stories from all over the world. And give him a follow on Instagram at Jaime Rojo. For what it's worth, Aaron and I have been complaining a lot since releasing our podcast about Instagram and not having the reach it once did. But like Jaime said, shifting baselines. So yeah, let's keep it going. There are ways of connecting people. We mustn't give up. Thank you so much again for listening. It's been a great year. Can't wait for 2025. I'm definitely going to hit 50 in 2025, and that's going to be quite significant for me. Thank you for all the kind comments. I hope these stories continue to inspire. And thank you again, not only to the Patreon supporters, but all the people that just leave really lovely comments, send me emails. It makes doing this really, really worthwhile. So keep sharing it, keep getting it out there, and we'll see you in 2025. Happy New Year.